What is up, cyber and crypto homies? Today is Monday, November the 18th of 2024. This is episode number 121 of the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. All the views and opinions on this podcast are solely my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of my employer. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at CyberCryptoGuy. Sorry, follow me on X. Dang it. I almost got it right. One of these days. All right, some interesting things to talk about today. Of course, we're going to talk about crypto and the sudden boom after the election of all of the coins, and we'll discuss all the various prices and where we think it's going from here. On the cybersecurity side of things, there was apparently a massive breach at, quote-unquote, several of the wireless carriers, so T-Mobile, potentially AT&T and Verizon, although details are still a little bit scarce on a lot of this, but it's definitely making the headlines here, so I'm going to dive into that a little bit. We're also going to talk a little bit about some Microsoft Exchange vulnerabilities, some Palo Alto vulnerabilities that are actually quite scary if you think about it. And then last but not least, data security and AI. All right, so we will first start with our lovely friends at Palo Alto Networks. Well, if you've been watching any of the headlines for the last, I don't know, a week or two, there was a headline that Palo Alto was warning of a quote-unquote potential vulnerability that was yet to be disclosed. And about 7 days later, I want to say, they finally came out and announced that vulnerability. Now, this vulnerability affects your Palo Alto firewalls if you have the management interface exposed to the internet, which I'm not sure that a lot of people do that to begin with. I would sure hope not, but if you do, make sure that you fix that. Make sure your management interface is not exposed to the internet. In a perfect world, your management interface is only accessible from inside of your network. However, I know in some cases, you know, you got to have it open to the public, right? In certain scenarios, so certainly understand there's a use case there, but if you do absolutely have to expose your management interface to the internet, consider putting some IP restrictions in there at the bare minimum to help mitigate this type of vulnerability. This vulnerability was pretty bad. I mean, you could exploit the firewall with, you know, pretty trivial exploit, gain root access, that kind of thing. So they first warned of this vulnerability on November the 8th, and that was the warning of the potential vulnerability, which is so funny because why not just come out and tell us what the vulnerability is? I don't know why they didn't, but regardless, they did come out finally a few days later and let everybody know what the vulnerability was. And again, it was pretty high on the CVSS. I want to say it was like a 9.8, if I recall correctly. So pretty high up there on the criticality rating, but nonetheless, they do have an article out there about how to, or best practices, I guess I should say, rather than how to. It's, yeah, best practices for your firewalls and make sure that you're not exposing your management interface to the internet. Well, they also came out today, I believe it was, with another article, may have been yesterday. That was today, excuse me. Okay, so two more critical vulnerabilities that they released today that are, again, very similar in nature. It's for the management interface. So one of them is authentication bypass, and another one is a privilege escalation flaw. So, yeah, so those are kind of the big ones. So three, I guess, in total that are, of you know, critical in nature. And then I'm sure there are some others that they released as part of other updates. So again, if you don't have your management interface exposed to the internet, you should be okay. If you do and you have to leave it exposed, set up some IP restrictions so that only specific IPs can connect to your management interface. Or cut that off completely from the internet and only make it available from your internal network. That would be the ideal scenario. So anyway, those were pretty big news makers over the last week or so, so I wanted to bring that up. But it's a pretty simple thing to mitigate with the management interface specifically. So some other news, there was an article, I guess it's been another, I don't know, at least a week, where it was reported that Chinese hackers hacked into several, was the word, of the wireless carriers. So there's only three really big ones here in the U.S. several could mean a lot of different things, so not sure exactly what they meant there. The details are still a little bit scarce, but T-Mobile did come out and say that it was an industry-wide attack. So even though it was an industry-wide attack, T-Mobile said that they have no evidence of access or exfiltration of any customer or other sensitive information as other companies may have experienced. Kind of throwing the other companies under the bus there, huh? But apparently this was a Chinese state-sponsored, my favorite word, threat actors, known as Salt Typhoon. Where do they come up with these names? Salt Typhoon. They apparently breached AT&T and Verizon and Lumen, as well as T-Mobile. So, yeah, it's interesting that T-Mobile says that they were hacked, but at the same time, they say we have no evidence of access or exfiltration. Maybe they're just speaking specifically to the customer data, because they do mention customer data there, but it just seems a little bit weird. So if they didn't get customer data, what in the world were they after, and what did they actually get, if anything? So apparently, I guess all that they were after was private communications, call records, and law enforcement information requests. That's a very strange thing to go after, but apparently they were very targeted in what they wanted to steal or hack. So this is kind of an ongoing story. I have yet to see anything from AT&T specifically. However, or even Verizon for that matter. So it makes you wonder, you know, what in the world is going on here? But the FBI and the CISA also confirmed that threat actors stole call data, communications from targeted people, and information about law enforcement requests. So yeah, it's just interesting that they've targeted those very specific things. It makes you wonder, was this tied to the election potentially? Yeah, I don't know. Really makes you start questioning things. And both, all three other carriers, Verizon, AT&T, and Lumen, all have declined comment. So yeah, makes you really wonder what's going on there, guys. What really happened? This is pretty interesting, but there are some notes here about their initial attack vectors in a lot of cases. Apparently, they were going after kind of their initial attack was using some Exchange server vulnerabilities, and they specified a specific CVE in here. So that's pretty interesting to go after a very specific vulnerability like that. And apparently they've, that's kind of their initial access vector. And once they get in there, then they can, you know, pivot anywhere they want to, essentially. So I'm very curious to see what AT&T, Verizon, and Lumen finally come out and say, if anything, because that's really sketchy to just not comment or not say anything at all when T-Mobile comes out and admits it. So what's holding back AT&T, Verizon, and Lumen? Is there something more that they just can't disclose yet? So I guess more to come there down the road. We'll see how that evolves. I'll definitely keep a pulse on that one, because that's definitely got my attention. Kind of curious what... So T-Mobile's been hacked, I don't know how many times, two or three at least already in the past. AT&T as well, at least twice that we're aware of. And now this one, how much worse was this? Did they still target the same kind of data? You know, who are those specific people they were going after? So it makes me wonder if it's election related, but we won't speculate too much here. We have to kind of wait for all the pieces to unfold here. So some other cybersecurity news. Microsoft apparently pulled one of their Exchange server updates because of email delivery issues. So if you're using custom mail flow rules, apparently if you apply this update, you're having mail delivery issues now. So that's unfortunate. I don't know a lot of folks that run their own Exchange servers anymore. If you do, God bless you. That is a difficult task, and you know, not for the faint of heart. So I think most people have moved to 365 in the cloud or some other cloud-based solution, G Suite, whatever you want to use. But in this case, this is for folks that are specifically running their own Exchange server and you applied this update. So they did roll it back, unfortunately. And so this is also scary because we're rolling back some of these security updates. And so now we're rolling back our security as well. And this is very, very scary because now you're vulnerable again once you remove this patch. So apparently Microsoft has not patch the vulnerability and will still continue to detect malicious emails, it says. After, so basically there was a malformed header vulnerability effectively, and so they're basically saying that they're going to roll back the patch, but Microsoft servers will now detect and prepend a warning to malicious emails. So I guess that's good. I'd rather just be protected personally. But anyway, regardless, there was 4 zero days that were fixed during the November 2024 Patch Tuesday fixes. And 2 of those 4 are actively being exploited in attacks. So yeah, very scary stuff there if you run your own Exchange server. And as with anything out there, make sure that you've got good firewalls in place. You know, make sure your Exchange server is not just hanging out on the internet with, for everyone to access. Firewall that bad boy off in every which way that you possibly can. Put it in its own little firewalled area or DMZ if you need to. Whatever's best for you, but just make sure you get it. Multiple layers of protection there. Speaking of protection, I wanted to talk about some data security stuff. So, as we all know, AI is the new buzzword, and everybody's talking about AI this and AI that, and that's great. However, the data security risks with AI are just really, really through the roof. And if you think about all these different tools that now use AI, well, the question you should probably be asking is, where is that AI? Where is that data center with this AI brain? Is it some sort of locally running AI on your computer? Is it a cloud-based AI? Does it take your data to a cloud-based AI to run it through whatever AI, you know, processes you want it to do? If it does take your data offsite, that's something you should really think about and consider when you're, you know, when you're looking at your data security as a whole. Do you really want these tools? I'm thinking of stuff like, even stuff like Grammarly, which seems really, you know, like not such a big deal because it's just kind of helping you write words better. However, Grammarly is going to need access to the entire document that you're looking at or the entire email that you're writing. So this is where it gets a little scary, because where is that data going? How long is it going to sit on those servers? You know, what are they, how are they protecting that data once it gets to that AI? So that's where you have to be very, very cautious and really try to understand what, where the AI lives. Is it locally running AI? Is it cloud-based AI? And then adjust your not only written policies, but any kind of protection mechanisms you may have to suit whatever AIs you are allowing. Now, this is very difficult because everything you use nowadays says it has AI pretty much. I mean, that's just the new buzzword they throw into everything. Oh, it's got AI now. Okay, cool. Everything does. Great. Well, where is that AI living? Where does it take your data? How do you protect your data? And so that's where it gets really scary. So DLP tools come to mind here, specifically a CASB or a secure web gateway of some sort, I think could really help protect that AI data or just block those AI sites altogether at your firewall if you wanted to. The problem is with remote workforce or, you know, folks that are not always on VPN, they could potentially access those sites with AI with no problem. However, if you have some sort of secure web gateway or a CASB-like application, then in that case, you could potentially try to block these at the secure web gateway. If you have always on VPN, you can do the same kind of thing, block it at your firewall. But either way, the AI stuff is just really getting crazy. And so with all these different tools that have AI, and you hear a lot about zero trust now too, of course. So at what point do you say, okay, we're only going to allow these 150 websites. Anything not on this list of 150 websites will be blocked, right? So that's where you get into more of the zero trust level of blocking different websites. You're only going to allow specific websites. Everything else is blocked on the internet. I think we're going to get to that level here really, really soon, especially with all these different sites that are spun up. And you can think about like phishing sites too, for example. Well, if I have free reign of the internet and some random phishing site gets spun up, well, I can easily access that phishing site and get phished. However, if I am blocking all other sites except for this grouping of allowed websites, then you could potentially protect your workforce a little bit better. So it's a lot like zero trust for websites, effectively. You're only allowing certain sites that you absolutely trust. And so that can help you with this whole AI thing and making sure that your data doesn't leave. Right now, there are other controls you can put in place with a CASB or a secure web gateway where it's checking, you know, the types of data that are being submitted to the various websites that you're using. So you can say, okay, anything submitted to ChatGPT or OpenAI.com, whatever their website is, anything submitted to there, we're going to inspect all the data. We're going to make sure nothing sensitive is going to that website just to protect yourself, right? So you can get that granular with it, but there's always that chance of, hey, what if my CASB doesn't block this one thing? Oh, we didn't think about this other thing and it let the data out, right? So that's where you have to think about, okay, what's easier? Is it easier to block everything and only allow certain sites? Or is it easier to allow everything and just block certain sites, right? So that's kind of where it's one or the other, right? And I think we're getting to the point where, especially on corporate networks, where we're going to have to go to the extreme of only allowing certain sites and literally blocking the rest of the internet. But we're not quite there yet with a lot of organizations. But I do think over time, we're going to have to get to that level because of all the security concerns, because of all the phishing and all that kind of stuff. Now, we talked a week or two ago about passkeys and how that's helping with phishing, and that's great. However, not all sites support passkeys yet, and not all sites support MFA, for goodness sakes. Or some of them do text-based or email-based MFA, which is just mind-boggling to me. Even our banking systems, which you would think would be super modern and way up to date and, you know, have all the latest bells and whistles, but they're still doing text message-based MFA. That's a huge problem, right? Why don't we get to a point where we're starting to use, you know, an authenticator app for your web, for your banking website? I don't know. Now, they do have tokens. I've seen tokens or YubiKeys for banking websites, but that's typically only for, you know, your cash management or business level customers that are doing wire transfers and things like that. But for your average everyday consumer, nope, it's just a text message. So that's where, as a you know, technology advanced world, we have to get to the point where these security controls are the default. And if they're not going to be the default, then you have to layer on other security measures to ensure that you're protecting your business and your data. So it's a very slippery slope. I've seen so many new tools nowadays that claim that they're using AI and all this fun stuff. And really, the questions are like, wait, where is it storing the data? Is this AI locally, you know, running AI? Is it some cloud-based AI? And a lot of times there's no mention of any of this in the company's documentation on their website. So you go to the website and say, okay, I'm going to look at company XYZ for this Excel plugin. You go to their website and it says nothing about how the AI actually works and what it's actually doing. Makes me even question if it's really even got any AI to begin with, but I digress. I think it's still a very big data security concern to have all these AI things that we don't know how much data it's taking. Where does it take it? Does it take it to some random AI data center, or does it do it all locally? If it does it all locally, I'm a lot less concerned. I think most people are. But if it's taking it, you know, to some cloud-based AI, all right, that's a little bit different. Where is the data going? What data are we sending? Can we protect that somehow? So all the fun things to think about when, you know, if you're in, you know, the approval chain for new applications that are coming through your organization, that's something you definitely want to look at, right? If, you know, what are the data security risks? That's such a big topic, right, in general, especially if these companies are going to have your data. And then, you know, it seems like every time you turn around, there's a hack, there's a breach, somebody got all their data ransomwared, and now it's going to be sold on the dark web. It's happening constantly. So how do you protect your most sensitive data? Just be very cautious of that and make sure that you, if you, you know, have to buy this particular software that's got AI, okay, well, let's make sure that it's got the right data security controls. And in my contract with that company, I've got verbiage in there that says that, you know, they're going to be held liable for anything like data loss or data theft. So anyway, that's kind of it for the cybersecurity side of things. I did want to touch on the crypto markets and kind of how things are going there. Now, it seemed like right after the election, the crypto markets just went through the roof. As of today, right now, Bitcoin is sitting at 91,000 296. I never thought I would say that number. That is just crazy to see. And really, 100,000 is very much in sight here. And if things keep going the way that they're going, I think that we could go way past 100,000 too at some point here in the near future. Especially once, you know, Biden is out the door and Trump is actually in, I think you could see a huge jump there as well. Ethereum right now sitting at $3,155. Ripple, or XRP, is $1.12. Stellar Lumens, 24 cents. Basic Attention Token, 23 cents. So all these, I mean, even Litecoin's up. It's up to $89. So all, you know, interesting stuff to watch. Of course, you got all the meme coins out there. You got Dogecoin. Solana's not a meme coin, but Solana's getting pretty good, too. It's at $239. It was all the way up at 248 fairly recently here within the last day or two. But then you got things like Dogecoin. We're at 38 cents, which is pretty darn good for Doge. Pepe coin, it still makes me laugh. Still a fraction of a penny, but it's also up, right? It seems like everything is up, 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 up. I mean, Pepe is up 57% over the last week. So if you had any of these coins prior to the election, you're probably doing pretty darn good right now. And I think that you're really going to start seeing all of these go up, because when Bitcoin goes up, you typically have all the altcoins following shortly thereafter. So my strategy personally, and this is not financial advice, of course, but yeah, once you see Bitcoin jump, it's time to jump into some altcoins and, you know, hold on to those for a while and see if they'll take you for a ride. But as with anything, only invest what you can lose, and don't, you know, definitely don't take my word for it. I'm definitely an amateur at all of this crypto trading stuff, but I do think it's fun and interesting. Some other crypto related stuff. It's really crazy. I get these emails and other messages, direct messages for people wanting to come on to the podcast and promote some sort of crypto something or other. I don't do that on this podcast. I don't do any advertising. I don't do any kind of sponsorships. I don't do any kind of anything like that. I don't feel like that is okay to do for me personally. I want to give an unbiased opinion. And if I have to say something bad about somebody, I don't want to have some sponsorship where I can't say that, right? So I'm trying to be as transparent and, you know, open and honest as I can be. And so that's why I don't have those types of guests on the show. That's why I don't have any kind of sponsorships or advertising. So I hope that everybody appreciates that a little bit, because I personally can't stand all the advertising. I think it's extremely annoying. I don't care what you want to pay me. I'm not going to accept any advertising. I'm not going to allow people to come on here and promote whatever random crypto they're trying to promote. I'm going to be as open, honest, and transparent as I can. And yeah, that's kind of it there. So if you're ever wondering why I don't have advertisements or random people on the show promoting stuff, that's exactly why. All right, folks, that's it for today. Appreciate everybody listening, and we'll talk again next week.